Well, once again, let me thank you for coming this evening, setting aside an evening's diversion, and I hope that this evening will be both, to a certain extent at least, entertaining and informative. The title of the lecture this evening is Fascism, Gun Control, and the Intelligence Community. It is a companion lecture and will follow directly on the lecture that I gave last month, The Militia Movement, Enemy or Pawn of the State? It's worth noting that in April of last year, America was shaken awake, ever so briefly, I may add, by the Oklahoma City bombing, and I've made my feelings clear about that in the past. It would not surprise me if McVeigh and Nichols were involved in some capacity. However, the logistics of that event suggest, quite frankly, that far more than just those two hockey pucks were involved in this particular crime. Looking at the event at face value, however, at least as our media have portrayed it, Timothy McVeigh, if we are to take the event at face value, Timothy McVeigh was influenced by a very powerful and significant American Nazi book called The Turner Diaries. That was also, by the way, the inspiration for The Order, a Nazi terror group in this country, which murdered Alan Berg, a Denver talk show host, and also robbed armored cars, killed a bunch of other people, got a lot of the monies from those armored car robberies out to various American Nazi groups. That group, by the way, the Order, was getting money from German fascists in Latin America, probably the old and consummately powerful Bormann group. One of the most remarkable political and economic achievements of all time was not only the survival, but the post-World War II triumph of the Bormann Flight Capital Organization, literally a Third Reich underground, and I mean that in the most literal sense of the world, which owns much of the world at this time, including, if my analysis is correct, most of the key elements of the United States. The Turner Diaries is about a Nazi takeover of the United States when the government tries to effect gun control, okay? And in response to this, the Nazi faithful rise, and they have it takes place in this book as the Day of the Rope, in which people of color, so-called race mixers in particular, are taken out and summarily executed and lynched. Again, from every lamppost, there's either a person of color or a Jew or a race mixer. Delightful scenario. But we should observe that the precipitating incident for the Day of the Rope was the government's attempt to take away weapons. In the lecture about the militia movement, by the way, I see many familiar faces here. How many of you heard that lecture, just out of curiosity? Okay, it looks like we got the advanced class here who have signed on for a major learning experience, and I'm glad for that. Just as I pointed out that the militia movement appears to be a dichotomy, many of the people in it are outright raving Nazis and fascists. Many of them are sincere patriots, with a capital P, and sincere conservatives, although generally badly misinformed. I also pointed out that as ostensibly anti-government as the militia movement is, in point of fact, there is an area of overlap between some elements of the government, primarily the Republican right, and the militia movements themselves. And in many respects, elements of the militia movement are a direct extension of the right wing of the Republican Party. And I also floated the scenario, a very Machiavellian one which I can't say for sure may be going on, but I suspect may be going on. Suppose you want to establish martial law and eliminate civil liberties and turn America fascist. Communism has no credibility. The Soviet Union's gone. Nobody believes in that. How about getting a bunch of right-wing paramilitary terrorists to commit a bunch of acts and then pass legislation restricting civil liberties, broadening police and surveillance powers, i.e. the counterterrorism bill, and the left and the liberals will all back it because they want to be protected from all these horrible fascists and right-wingers. And the laws will be passed and the legal precedents set for, and the legal decisions put on the books for rounding up the very elements who enthusiastically applauded the passage of that legislation. I am not saying that that is what is going on, but I would not put it past the powers that be to enact a Machiavellian scenario like that, and I suspect that may be going on. But just as the militia movement itself was a dichotomy, with as ostensibly anti-government and for all the hoo-ha that we hear from the militias about the government, and God knows I do not hold a brief for government abuses, I would hope again that my credentials in that regard would be reasonably secure at this point. But just as there is a dichotomy with regard to the militias, so too there is a dichotomy with regard to gun control itself. Now, gun control is almost universally portrayed as a liberal political issue. Among the reasons why some elements of the so-called progressive sector, and again, note the use of the term so-called, consider me a right-winger is that I'm opposed to gun control. Some of the reasons for that I will discuss this evening. By the way, for people who are serious about Second Amendment rights and protecting them, one of the most scholarly and effective arguments in defense of Second Amendment rights, from which I will read briefly this evening, is the Tennessee Law Review. This is the Law Review of the University of Tennessee Law School, and there are some really good articles about gun control in here, weighing it pro and con, some excellent essays. I'm going to excerpt those, one of them, pointing out the outright lies that have been bandied about in the media concerning gun control. Now, gun control is, by the way, I don't think it's an accident that this comes out of the University of Tennessee. For those people who might have to leave early, and again, my lectures are characteristically long, I will try to keep this one as brief as possible. And brief when you're talking about a Dave Emery lecture always belongs in quotes. It's not something, it's a relativistic concept if ever there was one. But many parts of this country, the South and West being two of the most important, are cultures in which guns are an inherent part of that culture. And if you move to take guns away from people in those cultures, you will be driving a lot of people who are not Nazis and fascists in the ordinary sense of the word. Many of them perhaps very conservative, many of them perhaps even rednecks, perhaps racist. But they're not Nazis and not fascists, but you're going to drive them into the arms of the forces of reaction by taking away the guns. And just as I raised the possibility at the end of the militia movement of a Machiavellian scenario in which right-wing and fascist terrorists would be the excuse for passing laws, which would then be used to sweep up and eliminate people of more progressive political persuasion, so too I wonder about gun control, because guns do not kill people. People kill people. A firearm is like an automobile. In the hands of a jackass, it can be an extremely destructive thing. In the hands of someone who knows how to use it responsibly and in a mature fashion, it is not a deadly weapon. Just as a car has to be steered in a direction in order to hurt somebody, a firearm has to be pointed at somebody, loaded, and the trigger pulled in order to hurt somebody. And it is the person wielding the firearm, just as it is the person driving the motor vehicle, that is responsible for the devastation that results from the abuse of these devices. They have their proper use, and they have their improper use. But I wonder, as we shall see this evening, the gun control movement, the whole issue of gun control, is also dichotomized. There are several trains running, and I wonder to what extent we may also be looking, as we take a look at some of the overtly fascist and intelligence community connections to the gun control movement, generally portrayed as a liberal political godchild, to coin a term. So, too, I want to ask the question. I'm not providing the answer, but I want to ask the question whether perhaps gun control is intended to affect political polarization, to take people in the South and West and rural farm areas, drive them into the arms of reaction. And if that sounds preposterous, just take a look at the political hay that Newt Gingrich and Bob Dole and Pat Buchanan and others have been making out of the issue of gun control. It is indeed, whether or not this was intended, producing political polarization. It is feeding the forces of reaction. It is channeling people over to the far right who might not otherwise go over there. And I wonder to what extent, as we examine the fascist and intelligence community connections to the gun control movement, I wonder to what extent this might be deliberately intended. I also want to stress, as we get ready to go into the meat of the lecture itself, that many of the points I will be making are necessarily speculative, and many of the points I will be making are questions that I am asking, and I do not pretend to have the definitive answer. However, I suspect that in the asking of the questions, the possible answer may very well be suggested, and I think members of the audience have to examine the facts and provide the answers for themselves and hopefully other people as well. Now again, gun control is generally portrayed as a liberal political godchild. As we're going to see, however, many of the forces behind or underlying the drift to gun control are not only not liberal, but are overtly fascist, and there are some apparent, note the use of the term apparent, connections to the gun control movement. Now, in understanding the drift to gun control, or the impetus for gun control, it's very important to understand that the issue of gun control once again overlaps the forces of fascism, the national security establishment, in a manner that the paramilitary right, although not coterminous with fascism, not coterminous with the national security establishment, so too the paramilitary right overlaps the national security establishment, and the area in which the gun control movement most significantly, in my opinion, overlaps the national security establishment, once again has to do with America's political assassinations. Just as I spoke last time at the last lecture about the Minutemen, an American paramilitary right-wing organization, which overlaps but is not coterminous with the domestic fascist groups, and which elements of which have been used for various covert operations, the U.S. intelligence community's clandestine war against Castro, or wars against Castro, and America's political assassinations in particular, which were domestic covert operations, so too we find the same area of overlap between the forces that have launched the gun control movement and the national security establishment, and once again, our political assassinations is one of the significant areas of overlap. And so too, there is an overlap between explicitly fascist elements and the gun control movement. This will appear to be utter poppycock, perhaps, to the uninitiated. When I talk about a connection between fascism and gun control, the uninitiated, and that's not meant to be patronizing or condescending, but they will perhaps say, good Lord, fascism and gun control, who baked this fruitcake? Which is understandable for people that are not familiar with the facts. The facts, however, suggest that fascist elements in this country are deeply involved with gun control, and there even appears to be a hard connection between the gun control elements involved in gun control and this country's political assassinations. Indeed, this country's political assassinations have served as a justification for the imposition or for the passing of gun control legislation. Now, in understanding the areas of overlap between fascism, the national security establishment, domestic covert operations, and gun control, the main name we want to understand is Thomas Dodd. He was a U.S. senator from Connecticut, a former FBI agent, also an individual who was on the U.S., quote, prosecutorial, unquote, staff at Nuremberg. Note my use of quotes, because indeed, in many ways, the Nuremberg trials were something of a whitewash, although a few of the more evident personages of the Third Reich were tried and executed. The fact of the matter is, even as the Nuremberg trials were going on, the elements of our national security establishment acting at the behest of those elements of corporate America who had supported fascism were passing the word down that the denazification procedures in Germany were to be relaxed, as indeed they were. Thomas Dodd was on the staff, the prosecutorial staff, quote, prosecutorial, unquote, staff at Nuremberg, and indeed his political resume, some of the key elements of which I'm going to sum up in just a second, indicate that Thomas Dodd is an individual whose political activities have overlapped the operations of fascism in the past. Now, Thomas Dodd, in addition to being on the, quote, prosecutorial, unquote, staff at Nuremberg, was a member of and very active on behalf of an organization called the American Security Council. Actually, I shouldn't say he was necessarily a member. He might just have been a fellow traveler and enthusiastic supporter, but he was very closely and actively identified with an organization called the American Security Council. I spoke about this briefly in my last lecture. That is a domestic, quote, security, unquote, outfit, a right-wing intelligence organization that was comprised initially of largely of ex-FBI agents, as Thomas Dodd was. He was formerly in the FBI, very close to J. Edgar Hoover, that defender of human rights and that noted liberal. The American Security Council was put together by a bunch of retired FBI agents who liked the work of Joe McCarthy's committees and were dismayed that he was cast down politically and sought to perpetuate the work of Joe McCarthy. The files, which served as the informational seed, the foundation, the seedbed, perhaps, of the American Security Council, were the files of Harry Jung's American Vigilance Intelligence Federation. This was an explicitly fascist and anti-Semitic group operated by Harry Jung out of Chicago in the 1930s that was actually a part of the Hitler-Goebbels anti-Comintern. This was the International Anti-Communist Alliance put together by Hitler and Goebbels and comprising not only fascist Italy and Imperial Japan, but also fascist and militantly anti-communist elements around the world. So with Harry Jung's American Vigilance Intelligence Federation and their files, which were then used as the seedbed the core database, so to speak, for the American Security Council, we are looking at an element of continuity between the fascism of the 30s and the 40s and the political reaction and the fascism of the more modern and certainly post-World War II period. The American Security Council went on to be very closely involved with what used to be called the World Anti-Communist League, or WACL. That in many ways was simply a revival of the old Hitler and Hitler Goebbels anti-Comintern of the late 1930s and early 40s. The American Security Council also had as one of its prime operatives General Charles Willoughby, nay Karl Adolf von Chepo und Wiedenbach. He was the German-born fascist who was MacArthur's chief intelligence chief from 1939 to 1950. An individual whose many, many connections, and he had more connections than a switchboard, not only in the United States, but abroad, where he was very close to the Reinhard Galen spy outfit, the anti-Bolshevik Bloc of Nations, simply a renaming and reconstitution of the Committee of Subjugated Nations, a consortium of Central and Eastern European fascist groups put together by Adolf Hitler in 1943. Also, Thomas Dodd was very close to a public relations firm in the United States called the Julius Klein Public Relations Firm. Julius Klein Public Relations Firm conducted much of the PR business for major German corporations in the United States. And a couple of lectures ago, I read about the Bormann Flight Capital Organization. The Bormann Organization essentially is the economic component of the Underground Reich, and I mean, and again this will sound crazy, the Third Reich, which survived to this day and is triumphing around the world. It went underground, it survived, it perpetuated itself, and is achieving what I believe to be one of the most remarkable victories of all time, albeit unrecognized by most people. One of the things that makes it such a remarkable achievement. Most of the liquid wealth of Europe was spirited out of Europe and secreted in corporate fronts in neutral countries around the world. The Nazis long anticipated their military defeat on the battlefield. And at the end of World War II, Hitler turned over the leadership of the NSDAP, the German Nazi Party, to the individual that I believe to be the most remarkable, or perhaps one of the most remarkable, certainly the most powerful, and in the post-World War II period, the most influential, one of the most decisive figures in all of modern history, that Martin Bormann, the Reichsleiter of the Third Reich. Bormann, like Otto Skorzeny, his partner in the Underground Reich, and like also, in my opinion, Heinrich Müller, the head of the Gestapo, who basically went underground with Bormann and with Skorzeny, and who maintained the Gestapo as an active, worldwide functioning organization. That'll sound again, you know, Jesus, who is this guy? Man, the Gestapo, post-World War II? Dude, you know, World War II was over a long time ago. Ha! World War II is ending right now, and the Axis wins. I firmly believe this, and I firmly believe that they have victory in their hands. And the decisive element, inextricably linked with the German core corporations and the German companies that have become so well known and so influential above ground, is the Bormann Flight Capital Organization, which is the largest landowner in Latin America, and which owns properties, both commercial ventures, real estate, and other things that match with the most powerful economic entities on Earth, even on a world scale. Germany as an economic entity could be thought of as a two-tiered consideration, with above ground, the German core corporations, Siemens, Daimler, Benz, and the ones that we've come to know, and beneath that, the very powerful, consummately powerful in my opinion, although largely unrecognized, Bormann Flight Capital Organization. The Julius Klein Public Relations Agency was identified not only, it was overtly a PR firm that handled the PR business for the German corporations in this country, it was also identified as a front for the BND, the Bundesnachrichtendienst, the German intelligence service, which was a direct outgrowth of one of the most remarkable military and intelligence organizations in all of military history, the famed, famed to those who understand World War II history and the history of intelligence, the famed Reinhard Galen Nazi spy outfit. Reinhard Galen, and you've heard this many times before, Reinhard Galen was Hitler's intelligence chief for the Eastern Front in World War II. His organization was called Fremde Heere Ost, or Foreign Armies East. It was Hitler's intelligence organization for the Eastern Front in World War II. Galen preserved all of his files, kept many of his operatives underground in the various territories that the Nazi armies surrendered to the advancing Red Army in World War II. He then made a deal with the Americans, and he agreed to turn over his organization to the service of the fledgling CIA and also military intelligence. 3 months after the end of the war in Europe, Galen was flown into the United States in the uniform of a four-star general, given the pay of a four-star general and Galen's spy outfit. Again, the Third Reich's Eastern Front Intelligence Organization, including thousands of SS and Gestapo veterans, with a good portion of the Odessa organization grafted on for good measure. The Odessa is the post-World War II SS underground, again, a contemporary organization, extraordinarily powerful, although largely unrecognized. Its nominal head, at least, was Otto Skorzeny. There may have been other operational heads as well. Skorzeny was Hitler's commando chief and one of the most respected and by the Nazis honored military figures in the Third Reich during World War II. And he also, like Martin Bormann, was an organizational genius, and I mean genius in the truest sense of the word. And they maintained the Underground Reich as a political, military, and economic entity, and have, along with Heinrich Müller, the Gestapo chief, who handled their security in the post-World War II underground phase of the Third Reich, they have much to do with the fact that it has not only perpetuated itself, but is achieving the victory that Hitler had desired, albeit not on the battlefield, but in the boardrooms of major corporations and within the national security establishments of many countries. The Galen Organization, in addition to serving as the CIA's Department of Russian and Eastern European Affairs, served as the de facto NATO intelligence organization. And finally, when the Federal Republic of Germany was incorporated, it was installed as West Germany's intelligence service, now the German intelligence service. It continued to supply the United States and NATO with the bulk of their intelligence, even when it was the BND. So here we have an organization which represents a projection not only across the Atlantic, but through the decades of the Third Reich's national security establishment. When Galen was nominally a prisoner of war, right, in 1945, he was still reporting at clearing his actions with Admiral von Dönitz, who succeeded Hitler as the overt above-ground leader of German Nazis, as well as with General Franz Halder, his chief of staff, indicating that the Third Reich's military chain of command was still operating even after the end of World War II and when Reinhard Galen was going to work, ostensibly at least, for the United States. The BND became the German intelligence service, the direct outgrowth and perpetuation of the Third Reich's intelligence service, and the Julius Klein PR firm was identified as a BND front in the United States that operated very closely with a German-American citizens organization headed up by a fellow named Austin App, last name APP, who was one of the seminal no-Holocaust theorists or seminal Holocaust deniers. Also, the ASC, like people like Charles Willoughby, very active with the anti-Bolshevik Bloc of Nations and very active with the Captive Nations Committee and many of the Third Reich-aligned organizations, which went on to become a powerful element of our intelligence system, our Republican Party, and which have wielded an enormous influence in the post-World War II period. Now, the Julius Klein PR firm and Thomas Dodd were closer than sin. Thomas Dodd actually was facing censure at one point. We're going to have a band out here a little later. That's going to be just delightful. So, what the heck? You know, a musical accompaniment to this de facto Wagnerian opera that I'm presenting here this evening. But Julius Klein PR firm and Thomas Dodd were extremely close. In fact, Thomas Dodd was getting large amounts of money and various gratuities bestowed on him by the Julius Klein PR firm. There was a congressional investigation undertaken into the Julius Klein's relationship with German corporations, and indeed the Klein organization was investigated as a possible foreign agent within the United States, which it most definitely was. It was a BND front organization, among other things. So influential was the Julius Klein firm on Thomas Dodd that Julius Klein was able to prevail on Thomas Dodd to travel to Germany in order to intercede with the German industrialists and financiers who were becoming understandably very leery of continuing their relationship with Julius Klein because of the adverse publicity, that he was getting in the United States. Ultimately, most of the German corporations and financial institutions chose to have their PR work done by somebody else other than Julius Klein. They're highly clever, and they did not want their PR work done by a jackass, or not a jackass so much as somebody who had a lot of bad publicity. You don't want your PR done by somebody who has bad publicity. It doesn't work real well. We should note that Thomas Dodd was very close to the American Security Council, very close to the Julius Klein organization, a BND front, okay, and the representative of German industry, not only the core corporations, but inevitably as a component of that, the remarkable Bormann Flight Capital Organization. And we should also note that Senator Thomas Dodd has played a role in the cover-up of the assassination of President Kennedy. One of the ways in which the Kennedy conspirators, explicitly fascist elements of our own national security establishment, operating with what I call the underground Reich and fascist elements around the world, one of the ways they were able to get many of the liberals who really knew what had happened to President Kennedy to go along with the cover-up theory is that they were able to successfully paint Lee Harvey Oswald as a communist or an agent of the Cubans or the Soviets or both. And the possibility that the American people might believe that a communist or an agent of the Soviets or Cubans had killed a very popular president, and Kennedy was extremely popular, not with the forces of reaction, but with the American people, this could perhaps lead to a Third World War. I talked, in fact, in the last lecture about the role of the 544 Camp Street, 531 Lafayette Place address in the painting of Oswald Red. One of the things that led to the painting of Oswald Red was the linking, falsely, of the assassination of Stefan Bandera, a Ukrainian fascist, a Galen operative, both when Galen was working for Hitler and when he was working for the United States and what used to be West Germany, the Federal Republic of Germany. Stefan Bandera headed up a Ukrainian fascist and nationalist organization called the OUNB, or Organization of Ukrainian Nationalists, B referring to Bandera. This group worked with the forces of the Third Reich in World War II, contributed people to the Einsatzgruppen and the mobile killing squads that followed the Third Reich's armies into the Soviet Union. They committed the liquidations of Jews, political commissars, communists, and other undesirables, who the Third Reich viewed as undesirables. They also contributed people to Ukrainian Waffen-SS divisions, and Bandera became a key operative of the Galen organization in the post-World War II period. Deputy Director of Central Intelligence Frank Wisner argued strenuously for allowing Bandera and his group to be employed by U.S. intelligence. On October 15, 1959, Bandera turned up dead, the same day, by the way, that Lee Harvey Oswald defected to the Soviet Union, October 15, 1959. Initially, it was thought that Bandera had died of a heart attack. Eventually, an alleged KGB assassin, and in my opinion, as well as the opinions of many, a probable Galen double agent, because Galen was very successful at penetrating the Soviet's intelligence and national security services, a fellow named Bogdan Stashinsky, S-T-A-S-H-Y-N-S-K-Y, you'll see that spelling in various forms, Bogdan Stashinsky turned up a couple of years after Stefan Bandera was found dead, and confessed that he had killed not only Bandera, but also another Ukrainian fascist named Lebed, using a special cyanide gas gun, which sprayed cyanide in the face of the victim, and this killed them, and it made the deceased appear to have died of a heart attack. The BND itself used just exactly such cyanide guns for some of their covert operations. Indeed, the Third Reich used a similar device. It eventually came out that Stashinsky had a broken shaft of a key which matched the head of the key which was still in the apartment, the lock of the apartment that Bandera had been using about a year and a half or so after Bandera's death, which in and of itself is sort of curious. Eventually, Stashinsky was convicted of the assassination of Stefan Bandera. One of the indications that Stashinsky was a probable double agent is that he only received 8 years for two counts of first-degree murder. Even with the relatively liberal sentencing that Germany had, and they have a more enlightened correctional system than our own, as do a great many other countries, 8 years for a double murder, two counts of first-degree murder, is an extraordinarily light sentence, and that suggests a very strong possibility that Stashinsky was actually operating on behalf of BND. The Soviets produced operatives claiming that Stashinsky was, in fact, a double operative for BND. I do not take the Soviet intelligence operative's word at face value. Believing the word of a spy or taking it at face value can be very risky. However, the curious discovery of the shaft of the key, if Stashinsky had actually been a KGB assassin, it seems probable that he would have disposed of this highly incriminating shaft of this broken key. And the fact that he only got 8 years for after confessing to committing two first-degree murders, that's an extraordinarily light sentence and suggests that strings were pulled behind the scenes. Elements associated with what were eventually to coalesce as the World Anti-Communist League. At this point, it was called the World Anti-Communist Congress for Freedom and Liberation, the WACCFL. One element of which, by the way, was the Anti-Communist League of the Caribbean, headed up by Guy Bannister and the people at 544 Camp Street, 531 Lafayette Place, who helped to paint Oswald red in a fashion I've delineated in past lectures, including the last lecture. Many of those elements were also Minutemen, by the way. The WACL, and in particular its press secretary, the WACCFL, and its press secretary, a former Batista intelligence operative. Fidencio Batista was the dictator who ruled Cuba prior to the takeover of Castro. Her name, Salvador Diaz Verson, last name V-E-R-S-O-N, began publicizing the disinformation that Oswald had been run by Department 13 of the KGB, and that, in fact, he'd been trained by the KGB to commit assassinations around the world. As had Stashinsky, allegedly. Interestingly enough, an article was floated in a major Philadelphia paper, as well as introduced into the Congressional Record, by reactionary Illinois Congressman Charles Kersten, last name K-E-R-S-T-E-N. Kersten was actually the counsel for Bandera's widow, Stefan Bandera's widow, at the trial of Bogdan Stashinsky in Germany. Again, the linking of the death of Bandera to the assassination of President Kennedy and the disinformation concerning Oswald as a Department 13 KGB assassination trainee and operative was one of the factors, and again, these elements floated by the WACCFL, was one of the factors that helped to convince more liberal elements who knew the truth about Kennedy's assassination to keep their mouths shut because they were afraid they might start a Third World War if indeed the perception that a communist operating on behalf of Cuba and or the Soviets had killed Kennedy got loose. One of the people most instrumental in publicizing the Bogdan Stashinsky Oswald KGB disinformation, very, very important for the cover-up of the assassination of President Kennedy, one of the people who was most instrumental in getting it introduced in the Congressional Record, was U.S. Senator Thomas Dodd, okay? Close to the Julius Klein public relations firm, close to the American Security Council that I've already spoken about, and as we are about to see in a minute, one of the most influential figures in crafting American gun control legislation, which, as we shall see, has drawn very heavily on the Nazi Weapon Act of 1938. Now, it is that what I'm about to run down is a speculative element. I cannot say for sure that this happened. Peter Dale Scott, in his very detailed book, Deep Politics and the Death of JFK, has floated the possibility that Oswald, in order to be given his cover, was actually operating on behalf of a private security firm which was contracting to do business with the United States government. There is speculation about the possibility that he may have been working for the Defense Industrial Security Command, who maintained security for American defense industries, or did at that time. There is also the very real possibility, and again, it's only a possibility, that Oswald may again have been an operative for a private security outfit that had contracted to do work for the U.S. government, and that he was working for a congressional committee headed up by Thomas Dodd. It may have actually been a subcommittee, I'm not positive offhand. This committee was investigating the availability of firearms purchases through the United States mail. Oswald was collecting all kinds of gun magazines. He was clipping out ads for firearms. And indeed, as many have pointed out, if Oswald wanted to get a gun in Texas, he didn't have to order one that was traceable through the mail. He could have walked into any gun store and bought a very effective firearm very cheaply that would not have been traceable. Yet he was ordering guns through the mails. One of his employers in New Orleans at one point was the William Riley Coffee Company. Bear in mind, again, that Oswald was supposedly someone who had defected to the Soviet Union with top-secret information about our radar nets and the U-2. Never prosecuted when it came back to the United States. One of the many indications that Oswald was an operative. That's utterly preposterous. And beyond that, then he begins hanging around with right-wing anti-Castro Cubans and defense industry, aerospace industry high rollers, wealthy petroleum industry executives. Not the sort of company that a per diem warehouse worker and professed Marxist and traitor to the United States generally keeps. One of his employers in New Orleans was the William Riley Coffee Company. Oh, by the way, Oswald also worked for at one point for Jagger's Child Stovall that was doing classified work for the United States Army. bloody, unlikely in view of how Oswald supposed it was. One of the many indications that he was a U.S. intelligence operative, given a left cover, infiltrated into left-wing organizations, then killed before he could defend himself. And again, the Oswaldist communist theory was one of the things that led many people who knew what had happened to Kennedy to cover up the truth concerning that assassination. William Riley, Oswald's employer, was also major financier of the Cuban Revolutionary Council. That was the CIA's anti-Castro Cuban umbrella group, subsuming the various anti-Castro groups under its umbrella. Again, a very unlikely person to be employing the self-professed communist Oswald, the only member of the New Orleans Fair Play for Cuba Committee, again, a pro-Castro group. But Oswald spent most of his time while working for William Riley next door at Adrian Alba's garage, which, by the way, handled vehicles that were used for FBI and, I believe, also Secret Service motor pools. I may be wrong about Secret Service. At one point, Alba testified that he saw Oswald take an envelope appearing to be filled with cash from an FBI operative. He spent all of his time sitting around Adrian Alba, much of his time, instead of working, he was sitting around Adrian Alba's garage clipping out ads from gun magazines for mail-order firearms. Peter Dale Scott has suggested, and again it's only a speculation, I think there's probably merit to it, but that Oswald may have again, while having his cover established, he may have been working as a contract operative doing investigations on the mail order firearms business for the Dodd Committee or Dodd Subcommittee. Of course, then later we have a provable trail where Oswald is ordering guns through the mail. This is used to help frame Oswald. We should also note that an individual who figures in the foreground of the cover-up of the assassination of Robert Kennedy also was doing work for the Dodd Committee. The LAPD group that was in charge with investigating the assassination of Robert Kennedy was called Special Unit Senator. Its head was an LAPD officer named Robert Houghton, but the two officers who actually handled the day-to-day operations of SUS were two Latin American L.A. policemen named Manuel Peña and Enrique Hank Hernandez, both of whom had done classified work for U.S. intelligence in Latin America, helping to train Latin American security forces. They both spoke fluent Spanish and English, and again, this is a curious choice to head up the investigation into Robert Kennedy's assassination, and they appear to have been less than vigorous in pursuit of the truth. We should remember that they both had backgrounds working for U.S. intelligence in Latin America. Manny Peña had done work for the Dodd Committee investigating Lee Harvey Oswald ordering the telescopic sight that was on that Mannlicher Carcano that he supposedly used to kill Kennedy, which was ordered from an L.A. mail-order firearms institution, retail outfit. So again, there is the possibility, in addition to the certainty now, again, bear in mind Thomas Dodd's heritage, Nuremberg, quote, prosecutor, unquote, American Security Council, domestic American fascist outfit with direct links back to the Hitler-Goebbels anti-Comintern, ex-FBI agent, very close to the Julius Klein firm, a BND front. He also certainly helped to float, was instrumental in floating the Bogdan-Stashinsky disinformation about, which helped to cover up the Kennedy assassination. And he may have had Lee Harvey Oswald working for his committee in order to check out the mail order firearms business. A speculative element, but one that is very significant. Now, we should note that Thomas Dodd was instrumental in crafting the 1968 gun control law that passed largely as a result of the public relations and media blitz that was conducted after the assassinations of not only President Kennedy, but also the two assassinations that took place within a couple of months of each other of Martin Luther King and Robert Kennedy. These gave the impetus for the passage of an American 1968 gun control law, which was crafted by Senator Thomas Dodd's committee, which may have been employing Lee Harvey Oswald in order to investigate the mail-order firearms business, hence Oswald ordering guns from mail-order houses. He could have bought a damn good weapon over the counter in Texas, and it would have been untraceable. Again, so perhaps the laying down of the trail of Oswald as Patsy was done in part, at least, by the Dodd committee. That is speculative. But we know that the Dodd Committee crafted the Gun Control Act of 68, largely as the result of the sentiment for gun control growing out of America's political assassinations, again, the Kennedys, Martin Luther King, and others. And interestingly enough, and this is one of the areas where the right wing appears to be accurate. The American Gun Control Act of 1968 was profoundly influenced by the Third Reich's Weapons Control Act, I've forgotten its exact title, but by the basically the Nazi gun control law of 1938. Indeed, Thomas Dodd requested a verbatim translation of that law while helping to draw up the 68 Gun Control Act. And this is one of the things that the right wing has been absolutely accurate about. Our gun control law of 1968 is largely based on the Nazi weapons control law of 1938, if not a verbatim copy. I've seen a few translated passages. I don't speak German, but it certainly has been profoundly influenced. It has been alleged by advocates of Second Amendment rights that indeed it is a carbon copy of the 38 weapons control law. I do not know if that is true or not, but I think it warrants serious investigation. We should note that the Nazi weapons control law of 1938 was passed, was instituted on November 11th, 1938, 2 days after Die Kristallnacht. That was the first large-scale Nazi pogrom against the Jews, and its name comes from the Night of Glass because so many Jewish businesses had their storefronts shattered. Jews were beaten. Many of them were killed. Jewish businesses were in synagogues were torched. 2 days after that, the Nazi Weapons Control Act was passed, or it was instituted. It also forbade Jews not only from owning firearms, but also knives and truncheons as well. One of the obvious aims of that being to keep weapons of self-defense out of the hands of Jews and others who faced imminent liquidation at the hands of the Third Reich. We should also note that again, bear in mind that the 68 Gun Control Act, heavily influenced by, if not the direct carbon copy of the 1938 Nazi weapons control law, once again was crafted by Senator Thomas Dodd, whose unsavory political resume I have delineated to a certain extent already. We should also note that there is yet another apparent national security and fascist and assassination connection to the impetus for gun control. On March 30th of 1981, Ronald Reagan was shot and seriously wounded by an assassin. My personal feeling is that this was not John Hinckley. I believe Hinckley was a diversion. I believe the real shooter was in all probability someone off to the side. However, we are told that the person who actually shot President Reagan was John Hinckley. John Hinckley Jr., John Hinckley Sr., his father. I'm going to go into Hinckley Jr. in a minute. John Hinckley Sr. had been a close personal friend and major contributor to the primary campaign of a fellow by the name of George Herbert Walker Bush. At the time of the shooting of President Reagan, the Vice President of the United States and the individual who would have succeeded Ronald Reagan as president in the event that Ronald Reagan had died. Okay.